Bonjour, bonjour à tous. Merci d'être venu pour cette rencontre avec Michael Moorcock. Michael Moorcock, immense auteur de fantasy, mais pas que, de science-fiction et de fantastique aussi. Vous connaissez tous Hawkmoon, vous connaissez tous Corum, vous connaissez tous Elric, évidemment. On va essayer d'aborder tous ces personnages avec lui et aussi une autre partie de son œuvre. Alors, on est doublement heureux d'avoir Michael Moorcock. Il y a 2 ans, Michael Moorcock était déjà sur cette scène. On avait fait déjà une première conférence. Alors, si vous avez la chance d'être avec nous, d'avoir été avec nous il y a 2 ans, eh bien, on va essayer de poser quelques questions un tout petit peu différentes. Et puis, si vous voulez réécouter la première conférence, elle est en ligne, notamment sur le site ActuSF. Michael Moorcock, on va commencer par parler d'actualité. La France, on a une relation un peu particulière avec Michael Moorcock. Et il y a notamment les éditions Glénat qui font une adaptation d'Elric en ce moment. Et le tome 2 vient de sortir. Je voulais savoir un petit peu, comment est-ce que vous voyez cet Elric qui est approprié par d'autres dessinateurs qui imaginent Elric?
This particular BD is just superb in my view, and as a work in its own right. As an interpretation of my work, it's again very intelligent, very understanding, and also confident enough to make it Julien Blondel, the writer, his own work, which is, I think, the important thing. It's one of the important things, is that these were all very good. The team that produced it were all excellent in their own right, individual right. But they came together Benoit, the editor, to make an incredibly good team. I mean, they all contributed. And even though the team has now changed a little, it's still an excellent team. It's just a wonderful, wonderful project altogether. So I can only say, in answer to your question, of course, that it's the best yet on every level. And I have very strong loyalties to some of the people who've previously done Elric. I mean, one of them, Jim Cawthorne, helped me visualize Elric. He was an illustrator. Philippe Druyer, a very early person who made Elric completely his own. There have been just some marvelous people, but this really is the best.
Elric est votre personnage le plus connu, l'albinos. Il y a eu plusieurs adaptations en bande dessinée, notamment. Il y a eu des auteurs qui ont fait des hommages à Elric. Est-ce que c'est facile de confier son personnage avec qui on est si intime?
Only if I've seen the artist's work in the first place. I mean, for instance, there's an artist called John Picasso who did a lot of the work on the recent American illustrated editions. And although I don't think I'd ever seen John do Elric, I'd seen his other work. And he in fact, done other covers for me. And it's really just the artist. Once I trust the artist, and this was true when I was commissioning art as an editor myself, you trust the artist, and then you say, you know, you do it, because otherwise there's nothing really interesting enough for the artist to get. They've got to make it their own in some way.
Quelle est votre relation après tant d'années avec Elric? Vous pouvez encore le voir en peinture, ou c'est vous avez pris de la distance avec lui?
I just read something somewhere. Somebody wrote that although Elric is a far more sophisticated young man than he was an old man, because I've been writing them backwards. As I've got older, he's got younger. But you know, maybe that's built into the Mel Nibonean character. They get steadily less and less sophisticated as they get older. Maybe we all do. So I haven't had any problems with that. Oddly, I've no real desire to write about any of my other series characters, apart from Jerry Cornelius, who's a totally separate entity, and is as much a technique as he is a character. But Elric is the only one that I still have ideas for stories for. And I'm very, very careful about any collaboration. So I've really only ever done the one collaboration, which is with Fabrice Collin here, which was successful. But I don't think I'd ever want to... I mean, I'd be happy to work with Fabrice again, you know, should that ever happen. But otherwise, I'm still feel he's still, you know, pretty much my character, which is why I've been very reluctant to... give him over to unknown people, and film and TV is much more of an unknown factor than say bande dessinée. So yeah.
On vous connaît à travers plein d'autres personnages, Hawkmoon, Corum, Eric Ozé, Jerry Cornelius. Qu'est-ce qu'il a de particulier, Elric?
Oh, I think, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Elric is me, and the other characters really are maybe a little piece of me, but nothing. Elric just is somebody I identify with in a way that I don't with any other of my of those fantasy characters. Simple.
dans votre parcours, à quel moment... il a pris sa place. Enfin, à quel moment vous êtes dit il est en train de prendre une dimension supplémentaire au point de devenir vraiment presque un mythe?
I can't really answer that. It's too loaded a question in a way. I don't know. Sorry.
Non, il n'y a aucun espèce de souci. Je voudrais faire un tout petit point sur Jerry Cornelius, qui est un personnage aussi un petit peu à part, dans une écriture parfois un petit peu à part, beaucoup de voyages dans le temps, beaucoup d'incarnations et de mouvements différents. Comment il est né, ce personnage, et comment est-ce que vous le voyez?
Well, again, this is something that actually gets more sophisticated probably in retrospect. Because I've learnt it was almost a technique that I discovered too early. The first novel was the first time in my own mind I'd found my true voice, the tone, the whole way I wanted to write. Although it's a fairly crude novel. I mean, the others became much, much less crude. But the other thing, and this is I didn't say this, Mike Harrison, M. John Harrison, who wrote the three very best stories of Jerry Cornelius, in my view. He said that Cornelius was as much a technique as he was a character, and that's true. And he understood that. A lot of the other people who've done Cornelius haven't really quite understood that technique. So it's just the way it works. I use him very much for immediate confrontation of current issues. So although his he developed in the 1960s. Every decade, he's had a slightly different persona, and obviously different subject matter. You know, at the moment, he's dealing mostly with the Middle East, as it were, because that's the thing that concerns us probably most immediately. And what I wanted was a character who could do that, who could move very easily between scenarios, who was defined by his context always, so that whatever context he was in, he changes to modify. And to me, that was, well, first of all, it was essentially an urban survival technique, a means by which you can exist in the city by changing, of course, minor changes in most people. And that malleability was the most important thing. And in dealing with that, I was also dealing with social malleability, with sexual malleability, and so on. I mean, it was the entire thing. Unfortunately, most of the interpretations, or commercial interpretations, such as the movie, the final program, had no notion of what I was trying to do, and frequently, I mean, Fust in the final program turned that ideal of malleability back into, you know, bad jokes about lesbians. I mean, that was what, and that's been probably my greatest disappointment.
on sent une, pour rester sur Jerry Cornelius, on sent une grande liberté d'écriture, mais qui est peut-être factice. C'était peut-être très difficile. À faire, c'est ce que c'est correct. C'était très libre.
Oh no! It wasn't free at all. The structure of those stories is very, very exact and careful. I'm a great classicist in that sense. But a lot of my work has been attempts to describe, if you like, chaos, but obviously not be chaotic in themselves, because I don't think that art is chaotic. I mean, I think that art is, in fact, probably one of the few shields against chaos that we have. Yeah, I mean, that was also part of the reason why I made him available to anyone else who wanted to use him. And I'm sorry, I'm obsessed with taking a drink. My mouth's so dry. Forgive me, I won't be a second.
Pas de souci. On fait une petite pause boisson. je vais en profiter pour... Pour évoquer un autre roman, c'est vrai qu'on connaît beaucoup Elric et toutes les incarnations du champion éternel. Il y a aussi ce roman Mother London qui vous tient particulièrement à cœur. J'ai lu que c'était votre préféré. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous en dire un mot?
Yes, I think it's even I'm probably in a way proudest of the Piat Quartet, which hasn't been published in, well, one has been published in France, but the rest haven't. But I think I like Mother London best of my books. I was writing the Piat. I finished the second of the quartet, and the books are, although they're comedies about the Nazi Holocaust. The idea is to try to find the reasons for the Holocaust, something that we're constantly concerned with. But it does mean a lot of very depressing reading and watching of TV clips and, you know, whatever you can find, and it gets you pretty miserable. And so after the second one, and there were two more to go, I thought, you know, bugger this, I'm not going to continue any longer for a while, torturing myself. So I actually wrote what was a love song, really, to London, my home city then.
Justement, vous parlez de beaucoup de Londres, évidemment, dans ce roman, mais la place des villes, il y a des villes dont on se souvient, comme
Talron, par exemple. Je ne sais pas si je le prononce très bien. Quelle est la place pour vous des villes? Est-ce qu'on peut dire que parfois c'est presque un personnage en lui-même?
Oh yes, definitely. I mean, again, conscious literary decisions. I don't know why that, I always have attempted to do that, to show to return briefly, and I'm sorry to do this, to the Piat Quartet. There's lots of cities in that. There's many, many cities. It starts in Kiev, Moscow, down to Odessa, and then there are others in the following stories, and they're named after cities. And the cities almost always are described in terms of personality. Paris, Rome, I mean, wherever he goes, it's really me describing cities in that way. And in a way, I think they are the nearest thing we have to, and I don't want to offend anybody here, but the nearest thing we've got to God, which is a huge number of people getting together to conspire in producing this single entity. So that's how I see it. I'm probably crazy, but.
C'est aussi souvent un refuge presque pour vos héros, certaines villes, non?
Tanalon, yes, definitely. One city.
Yes.
although to me, I always feel safer in a city. Even though I live in the country half the year and I live in Paris the other half. There was some sort of gang fight in our street yesterday, or rather the day before yesterday. A couple of big explosions and cops all over the place, just across the street from us. We had no idea what was going on. I remember thinking to myself, I'd still rather be here with the explosions than living in the country and being safe, you know. I really am. I mean, I'm pretty much a committed. Why I ever found myself in the country is a long story, and I'm still not entirely sure how I got there.
Vous avez commencé à l'aborder. Vous avez parlé de votre travail lorsque vous disiez que vous regardiez beaucoup de documentaires et vous écriviez des livres et que ça vous rendait parfois un peu triste. Comment est-ce que vous travaillez justement aujourd'hui, Michael Moorcock? Quels sont un peu vos sujets et comment se déroulent vos journées?
As far as the days are organized, pretty much the same. No, that's not true. I'm lying. I'm a terrible liar. Ideally, I get up in the morning and go to work the same time as everybody else, you know, and stop. So it's a sort of 9-to-5 job, or 9-to-6, or 7, or you know, whatever. But I haven't really, I don't think, worked quite like that since I moved to Texas and became ill. That was the problem. I mean, this is another example and a great moral to everybody. I moved from a city which is supposed to be super unhealthy to a rural Texas which is supposed to be very, very healthy, and immediately caught an autoimmune disease because my immune system was too good for the environment. and so it's true, if you leave the city, you're dead. That was almost true for me. As a result of that, my schedules and so forth stopped being as strict as they used to be. But I work all the time. I mean, I can't help it. I've got several projects on, you know, at this moment. I'm doing a musical project in Paris. I'm writing a series of short stories and a novel, a second novel in a sequence I've just started. The recent novel did make me miserable. Generally speaking, I don't get miserable writing, but The novel's called The Whispering Swarm, and it's an attempt to produce a true autobiographical novel with a true fantasy novel plus an historical novel. So I'm trying to sort of bring them together and make it work. It's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, I don't know, but it's actually quite difficult to do, or at least honestly. And I had an appalling time writing it. I mean, it was just because the problem was I was having to face my past, look back at my past with as cold an eye as I could. I didn't really like what I saw, so that didn't help. I had to be careful not to upset my children because I didn't want my relationships to where they touched on them to make them unhappy. So it was quite hard to do, and I think people seem to like the result. Some people think it's my best book, which I'm glad about because it was agony to write. It was really awful, and I was so glad when it was over. And when I say over, I mean it went into draft after draft. My wife, who is still my best editor and a very, very strict and very unpleasant editor, sometimes I have to say, she's kept sending it back to me saying, no, you've got to do another draft. And I kept thinking, hoping it was over. You know, is it over yet? Is it over? No, go back. That one was miserable. Otherwise, I really do enjoy writing. I enjoy just it's almost like singing, you know, it has some of the same pleasure anyway.
Et justement, alors, de quoi parle ce livre? Quel est le sujet?
Well, it's my early years, into the New World period. It's about an area. Sorry.
There we go. Got it.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Thanks. It's about an area of London known as the Alsatia or Alsace. And the reason it was called that was because Alsatia was neither in France nor in Germany. And Alsatia was neither in neither within London nor outside of London. It was deep inside of London in around Fleet Street, the Fleet Street area, and it was a. They had them in Paris as well. It was a retreat, a thieves' retreat, really, where highwaymen and robbers fled to escape the law, and it had a religious. It had been a Carmelite abbey. And the Carmelites were granted, at a time when kings, both in France and in England, were trying to prove their piety and their religious qualities. The Carmelites got enormous benefits from that. You know, they had to flee from the Holy Land, and so they had all this land right. Even then, very much in the city or close to the real city, and gradually it became first of all, of course, a religious retreat where people under religious persecution came, and then thieves. So that's that place. Historically, there are now only streets named after the Carmelites, who were known as the White Friars in London. So the idea is that this place has actually continued to exist, but without as being aware of it any longer. And the abbey is still there, and the friars are still there, and it's still a retreat. So that's the fantasy, the chief fantasy element. The area appears to exist in different periods. The outside period can often change, so you're never sure whether you're stepping out into your world or another period in time. So there's a period in time which is the time of the English Revolution, the time that Oliver Cromwell and Charles I was executed. And there's a plot to rescue Charles I, and that's purely realistic. So there's two forms of invention, and then what I hope is a fairly truthful account of my early life and up until the time I started editing New Worlds. Some of that time is also in the book. The next book will not have as much autobiography in it.
Il y a beaucoup de voyages dans le temps et vous jouez beaucoup avec le temps et les dimensions dans vos différents romans et tout au long de votre carrière. Pour quelle raison? Qu'est-ce qui vous attire? Est-ce que c'est le plaisir de mettre en danger un petit peu un personnage qui passe d'une temporalité à l'autre? Ou est-ce que c'est parfois le plaisir de jouer avec la matière historique, l'histoire?
I think it's because I'm really a science fiction writer writing fantasy, in the sense that there's usually an object to what I'm doing. I'm interested in an historical period and examining perhaps something about that period. If you having the same characters moving in different places and times is very useful, again, for malleability. I understood how I came to do it. I had no intention, obviously, originally, of writing it that way. But two things. I just hit on the realization that an author really does not have many characters. There are very few. I mean, you may change the names, but they're really the same character. And it seemed to me a waste of time just to keep changing the names and saying, this is a different character. On the other hand, the same character, as in the Jerry Cornelius stories, will behave differently in different contexts. So it's a good way of examining a character, how a character responds. And the character can be a villain in one story and a hero in another and so on.
Un petit mot sur le multivers. On vous connaît aussi pour cette notion d'espace et de dimension qui s'entrechoquent. Comment est-ce que...
Si.
Ok, je voulais juste reparler un petit peu du multivers. Comment est-ce que vous êtes venu à imaginer toutes ces dimensions? Et puis, je sais qu'il y a des physiciens qui vous en ont parlé et qui ont essayé de le modéliser. Parlez-nous un petit peu de tout ça.
Well, I think the whole creation of the multiverse, and I was one. Excuse me. This whole thing's collapsed. It's all right. It's okay. It's me.
Okay.
Done. The whole creation of the multiverse was, I think, as a part of the zeitgeist in both in religion and in science, in culture in general. In that, the Big Bang theory, which came about in the 50s. It took a while to permeate into the common consciousness, the idea of the Big Bang Theory, with everything essentially being entropic, that ultimately everything would fade so into essentially what would be fundamentally nothingness. And I think it was an idea that that alarmed, I mean, I don't mean in any hysterical way, but just on a very profound level, really, the thinking world, the scientific world, and the religious world in particular, I think. And as a result, there were a few people. I was the only non-scientist. But there were one or two others who were considered pretty crazy at the time. I mean, they were really marginalized by the scientific community, so they seemed crazy, even just out of frustration. And all of us, around the very, very early 1960s, myself in 1961, conceived this idea of a physical multiverse. This wasn't quite the same thing as the idea of alternate worlds, which had been an idea that had existed for a long time. Because alternate worlds, I mean, they weren't very. It wasn't a very sophisticated model. If you were called upon to explain it, it was usually explained very, you know, in a very simple way. Branches, you know, one branch goes this way, one branch goes that way, but no real scientific sense of what it was. And I had no. I mean, I'm useless scientifically, at least on an ordinary level. But I just had the idea of a physical multiverse, something that could exist, and could the more I thought about it, and the more other people came up with ideas, Mandelbrot, for instance, I sort of began to assemble a genuine model and a notion of how such a multiverse could exist, what the mass involved was. I mean, all kinds of ways in which it would work, all in layman's terms or pseudo-scientific terms. But it's good enough to, you know, what science fiction writers have always done this. They throw the idea out, and a boy of 15 reads the story and grows up to be the scientist of 30 who actually creates the math or does the math. You know, then an engineer comes along and, you know, sees the math and sort of puts it into practical into practicality. As it developed for me, I was able to fit it into my own idea of my own, not idea, Balzac had that idea, but my idea of the malleability of human beings, how they behave in different circumstances, and give it a kind of science fiction reality. Even though I don't actually like rationalization very much. I think it limits the imagination too much. So I was never a very keen science fiction fan. I mean, some I liked a lot. But it was actually the rationalizations of the Campbell era that I reacted against, because I felt they were limiting and so on. So anyway, I've gone off the subject. But yeah, I mean, the multiverse was wonderful. It was a perfect vehicle for me. And the good thing is, something I've always tried to do, or been wanting to do, is to bring together full-fledged fantasy with realism, and have the same characters in different stories. I've got this pain medication and it's dried my mouth up. I'm very, very sorry.
En tout cas, c'est vrai que le multivers a fait des rêver des millions de lecteurs. La science-fiction et la fantasy vous ont accompagné toute votre carrière, finalement. Qu'est-ce qui vous plaît encore dans les genres de l'imaginaire ?
Well, I don't. I very rarely read fantasy or science fiction unless somebody sends it to me for an endorsement or something like that. Occasionally, I read for the writing, I think. Occasionally, a writer comes along who is a very good stylist, and they've always existed, but there aren't that many of them. And those are the ones I usually find myself reading. I like China Mieville a lot. M. John Harrison again. I mean, they're just certain writers that have a certain sensibility and but as a genre, I don't watch it. I mean, I rarely see most of the sort of blockbuster science fiction movies. I don't watch Game of Thrones. I did enjoy. Oh God, I can't remember its name. Anyway, there was one TV series. Was it Firefox? Firefly? Anyway, I saw it in France first. I thought it was French. It was that good. I mean, I thought, wow, you know, this is good stuff. Turned out to be American, but it only lasted, I think, a season or two seasons. Pure space opera. I love space opera. I mean, really, real space opera. I don't like Star Wars very much, but I like. There was a really bad one done by American International called, I think, Battle Beyond the Stars, which was an actual space western. I really enjoyed that. So I actually involved pulp probably more than anything.
Ma question, c'est plus qu'est-ce qui fait que vous aimez toujours la science-fiction en tant qu'écrivain ou la fantasy au point de continuer à écrire en science-fiction et en fantasy? Qu'est-ce que vous permet l'imaginaire?
I think, obviously I still write it, so I must still like it. I've never thought about it. I do, yes. My, although I write novels of character and enjoy writing novels of character, I'm really, by inclination, a science fiction fantasy, a visionary writer, whatever you want to call it. That, I mean, I loved that stuff when I was a kid, and enjoyed it all the way through and still write. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it is exactly. I think it's entirely personality. There are academics who, although they seem extremely grand and talk and very, when they come down to discussing, a Thomas M. Dish story, become really enthusiastic. I was at a conference in Toronto a few years ago, and Derek Walcott, the Caribbean poet, had just won the Nobel Prize for Poetry, and I mean, very distinguished, very good poet. And and he came up to me. I mean, he sought me out. He said, "Oh, you know, I really love Warlord of the Air, great book," you know, and so on. And I was just taken aback. But that's it. You know, I mean, it doesn't. It's just how some people love that stuff. Some people find it bafflingly, useless. It doesn't do anything for them. And I think it's entirely personality the tendencies of those tendencies.
Il nous reste un petit quart d'heure. On va prendre quelques questions, s'il y en a. Ah, monsieur a une question. Attendez, avec le micro.
Good evening, I'm Olivier.
Est-ce que vous pouvez la poser en français pour le reste de la salle, si ça ne vous embête pas?
Vous avez dit que vous étiez Elric. Alors je me demande, qui est Stormbringer? You said you were Elric, so I wonder who is Stormbringer, the demonic sword.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that here, and I couldn't very easily hear you, so I didn't really catch the
question.
The question.
You said Elric was basically you, your personality,
oui.
And Elric is Elric, but it has also a demonic sword which is called Stormbringer. So I just wonder, if you are Elric, who is Stormbringer?
My landlord.
Qui est Stormbringer?
Yeah. Well, he's a very bad sword. Who I keep in my broom cupboard at home. He actually does exist. Somebody made a beautiful sword and sent it to me. But I'm afraid it'll get out and kill the cats, so I have to keep it in the broom cupboard. He's who you want him to be, or Stormbringer is who it wants you to think he is, I think. I'm not dodging the question, but I think that is the answer to the question.
Stormbringer étant chacun de nous. Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question? Oui, monsieur devant.
Is there anyone?
Oui.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Vous avez exploré le multivers avec les différentes versions du champion éternel. Avez-vous envie de continuer et peut-être créer d'autres versions du champion éternel? D'autres Elric, d'autres Eric Ossé, d'autres Corum? Ou est-ce que pour vous cette histoire est close? Et donc, on restera sur ces quelques incarnations qu'on connaît déjà.
I do write more Elric stories. That's not a problem for me. I always think of new Elric stories. I think of new Jerry Cornelius stories. But when I killed Corum, I meant that death to have some sort of resonance. I don't think I could easily resurrect him, because it was important for him to die in the final book. So there's six books you don't have to read. Hawkmoon, I've already written some in books that haven't been translated into French yet. And in some ways, he's easier for me to use because when he relates to the Dark Empire and the villains, there's still things I can write about there, but not a great many. It's entirely dependent on. I don't need to create a new one, because I've got some good old ones I can still use. So I can put those into different circumstances. So the short answer is, with Elric and Jerry Cornelius, yes. New Eternal Champion, probably no. And yeah, that's it.
Est-ce que quelqu'un a une autre question? Vas-y, monsieur.
Bonsoir. Est-ce que vous diriez que vous avez...
Oh, okay, sorry. I'm sorry.
Oui. Est-ce que vous diriez que vous avez écrit Elric un peu en réaction au Seigneur des Anneaux et à une certaine Elric Fantasy bien pensante?
Not in reaction to Lord of the Rings, because when I wrote Elric, I hadn't read Lord of the Rings. I actually interviewed Tolkien, who is extremely nice, a very nice man, who took it very well when I told him I hadn't actually read any of his work. I have reacted to Lord of the Rings since then. And Elric could be seen certainly as part of my personality, in that Elric's a very different kind of character in a very different sort of world. I don't like Lord of the Rings because for me the tone has the reassuring tone of the child's nursery. Which I think is probably true of a great deal of English fiction. It's a great deal of certainly American and English fiction. I don't like nostalgic fiction. I don't like the tone that comes from nostalgia, except in very, very rare cases where it's being used for a particular purpose. I mean, you could argue that Proust was nostalgic, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a certain... usually it's a tone in the prose which looks back sentimentally at a simpler world, frequently the world of childhood. I can't stand child narratives. I'd like to see them all boiled in the same pot. So it's really more to do with a generational argument between my generation and of confronters, if you like, and Tolkien's generation, which did its best to sentimentalize, in particular, the First World War, which he had grown up in, and that part of that sentiment had to do with noble self-sacrifice, and I've done noble self-sac. I mean, I'm a great believer in it, but somehow it got too a little bit too I don't know, lachrymose. Anyway, I didn't write Elric in reaction to Tolkien, but I did write Elric in reaction to Tolkien's generation of writers. I think that's fair. Sorry. Boring answer.
On a le temps pour encore une ou deux questions. Est-ce que quelqu'un veut se lancer?
Oui.
Et le micro arrive.
Merci. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Est-ce que vous voyez une revue comme Interzone comme la continuation ou l'émule de ce que vous faisiez avec New Worlds?
I don't think so. In a way, it seemed to me to be a reaction to what I'd done in New Worlds, which isn't to say I don't like Interzone. I think Interzone's is a very good magazine. It's printed some extremely good stories. But it didn't have the same intent as New Worlds. New Worlds was looking at the world of literature in general. We were operating in the big world, if you like. We had no intention of attacking science fiction as such, even though we weren't always completely clear about what we were doing. I mean, I can clarify it now in retrospect. But that wasn't obviously always what we were sure of. We weren't entirely sure of anything, except that we didn't want to... we didn't like the rationalizations that existed in most science fiction. We liked the imagery, the visionary imagery, but Campbellian science fiction was to me anathema. It actually destroyed imagination and was almost it was far from visionary. In tone, it was reactionary. Which isn't to say that Interzone was reactionary in that same way. I don't think it is at all. I think if the editors had had their way, they would have published a lot more of good fiction by the likes of J.G. Ballard, because both two editors were great Ballard fans, and would, if Ballard had wanted to publish there, he would have, and they really would have been glad of it. So, and that might have characterized some of the magazine a little more. But in a way, what it was what the science fiction new wave was, which wasn't what we were. I mean, there's so much confusion in this and it'll probably remain confused because I'm confused myself. But the new wave, as I see it, was an attempt to improve the literary standards of a genre, science fiction. New Worlds was an attempt to borrow from science fiction a non-generic kind of fiction. Some ultimately all fiction, all things turn into genre, but they have to go through a stage of not being genre, if you like, or not being easily identified in any way. And that's what we were trying to do. We weren't really science fiction writers trying to... I mean, some of us, obviously, some of the writers were. I mean, and they were very good. I didn't have any prejudice against good science fiction. But I mainly saw what I did in, say, Jerry Cornelius as taking some of the elements from science fiction to create my own kind of fiction. I think that's what a number of people do nowadays. And so everything that I was trying to do with New Worlds was to, if you like, blend the literary world with the generic world. I was all part of a whole movement that happened here in France as well, where there was a real attempt to move popular ideas up, popular fiction, popular genres of any kind, and move it into the mainstream and blend it with the mainstream. That was really what was going on with all of that. With Interzone, it was a proper new wave science fiction magazine. It improved the standards. Its literary values were good, and so on. The short answer is I don't think it was a real reaction. I think it was just it happened almost independently. Those writers did need somewhere to publish, and I was very glad that Interzone continued. Because I would have published the same writers, or many of the same writers. I wasn't against good writing.
Peut-être une dernière question courte avant qu'on rende la salle. Une fois, deux fois, trois fois. Alors, je vais vous laisser. Ah, si, madame. Hop, 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 ça. N'appuie pas trop vite.
Good evening. I'm going to... try to ask the question in English. You said you don't like The Lord of the Rings, but at the same time we can think about Harry Potter, which is a really childish book, but at the same time it's really mature. What do you think about it?
Nothing.
Because nothing at all.
I haven't read it. I read one page, and I didn't, you know, I thought, okay, good. I've nothing against it at all. But I just haven't read it. I've seen some of the films, two of which I must admit I slept part of the way through, but I'm getting old, so I probably sleep part of the way through any film. Although my wife and I slept through the same film, so maybe, but so I really don't. I wish J.K. Rowling a lot of luck. She's used her success very gracefully, and she seems an extremely nice woman. But I know nothing except what I've seen in the movies. I'm afraid. Sorry, I can't.
On va y aller, malheureusement, le temps qui nous est imparti est terminé. Merci à vous.
Derrière nous, Déborah Acnès. On aura aussi une conférence sur l'enfance et l'intelligence, une rencontre avec un jeune auteur, Julien Elbrock, au-dessus. Merci à tous. Merci à Michael Mocock. Et tout de suite, les dédicaces.
Merci. Merci beaucoup. Thank you. Thank you.